Piece of time again. Putting on the nylon padded gloves and black woolen hat I'd bought myself at Stockman, I got out and hit the key fob. The four ways flashed as the central locking did its stuff, but I couldn't help that. Setting off down the gravel road, I made sure the hat didn't cover my ears. I was on a recce. I needed them to be able to work, without fighting to hear through half a lamb's coat. It was bitterly cold after the snug warmth of the Saab, and there was no noise or light. All I could hear was my own breathing and the snow crunching an inch under my feet before it compressed onto the hard ice beneath. My whole world was trees, snow, and a very cold nose and ears. Once at the top of the track, I stopped, looked, and listened. Nothing. It would take another 15 minutes for my eyes to adapt to the lack of light. Then, with any luck, I'd be able to see a little more of the tree line than just a wall of black. I turned into the track and started slowly down it. A lot of vehicles had obviously been up and down. There was no snow in the ruts on either side of the small central mound, just compacted ice. The trees were hard up against the edge of the track. 3 feet in front of me was pitch black, but I knew it wouldn't be like that for long once my night vision kicked in. I moved like a tightrope walker along the rut to cut down ground sign. The last thing I wanted was to slip and fall in the snow at the side of the track, leaving evidence that even a 5-year-old would pick up. After about 5 minutes, I began to see weak, intermittent lights ahead in the direction of the target. The beams flashed up into the sky or straight at me, disappeared for a while, then bounced towards me again. I knew exactly what they were. Vehicle lights, and they were coming my way. I couldn't even hear the engine yet, so it would be impossible for them to see me. The lights continued to flash against the trees. There was nothing I could do without leaving sign but dive out of the way. The rumble of the engine reached me, and brighter beams of light swept the area around. I faced the drift at the trackside, hopefully aiming between 2 trees, rocked back to try to get some sort of momentum, then leaped. I managed to clear the first few feet of snow, rolling like a high jumper, and landed like a bag of shit. The snow lay over solid granite, and I hit it hard, knocking the wind out of my lungs. I started to crawl like an animal, trying to burrow under the branches. The vehicle was getting closer. Still facing away from the road, I dug myself in and waited in the freezing snow, listening as it closed in on me. The transmission was in low ratio, suggesting a 4x4. It finally drew parallel with me, its wheels crunching into fresh snow on the side of the track as it was steered offline. Without hesitation, it kept on going. I raised myself slowly onto my knees, keeping my right eye closed. At least that way, I would save 50% of what night vision I had. The smell of diesel hung in the air. The track was about 5 or 6 meters away from me, and it was a 4x4 for sure, but I couldn't make out what type or how many were inside. All I could see was a massive ball of white light in the front and a red one at the rear, moving slowly along the tree tunnel, followed by a cloud of diesel fumes. I watched and listened as the light died. They must have reached the top of the track because I heard revving and the transmission ratios change. Then the noise disappeared completely. Crawling on my hands and knees to avoid the branches, I made my way back to my impact site. Stood up, put 1 foot forward and launched myself over the bank again. My right shin connected painfully with the central mound, and the combination of stones and hard ice did its work on me big time. I lay on my back in one of the ruts, holding my shin, rocking, taking the pain and thinking of the money. After a minute of feeling sorry for myself, I got up and checked that the snow on the side of the track was still untouched. My dive had been Olympic, but the pain had been worth it. I was covered from head to toe in snow like a crap skier. Brushing as much of it off me as I could, I readjusted my hat and carried on down the track, walking the tightrope with a bit of a hobble now. After about 1,000 meters, my night vision fully returned. I also started to hear the low, continuous rumble of what sounded like a generator. What had been concerning me most all along was, how many bayonets? How many were going to fight if I was compromised and couldn't run away? If there were, say, four people in the house, two of them might be Tom-type characters who'd played Quake for years but had never held a gun. But the other two could be Hoods who had, and who'd go for it. They were the bayonets, male or female. The term went back to the First World War. When it wasn't the whole of an enemy battalion of 1,200 that you had to worry about, it was the 800 fighting men. The remaining 400 cooks and bottle washers didn't matter. I didn't know how many I'd be up against, and Liv couldn't tell me. It was quite worrying. Getting to the house to discover there was a Hoods R Us convention going on in the front room would not make for a good day out. The track went gently downhill, and I got closer to the noise. It began to sound quite substantial. If they were running lots of machinery, they would need more juice than the trickle the local substation would give them. To check if they were on the mains, I tried to look above me for power lines, but it was too dark to see anything. The track began to curve. As I rounded a gentle right-hand bend, the ground started to open up on either side of me. The tree line here wasn't so close to the track. I could see two dim lights directly ahead, maybe 100 meters away. Now that I was in line with the house, the rumble of the generator was louder still, channeled towards me by the trees. Cupping my hand round my wrist, I pressed the backlight on Baby G. It was just after 4:45. Edging forwards, still in the rut, I kept looking for places to dive if the vehicle came back or there was some other kind of drama, such as coming across the Malaskaya on the same sort of outing. I was a bit pissed off this was the only approach route available to me, but any other would leave sign. Every 5 or 6 paces I stopped, looked and listened. The trees stopped about 5 meters from a fence that I could now clearly see in front of me, leaving an empty area running left and right of the track, about 2 or 3 feet deep in snow. A large set of double gates was directly ahead. Keeping in the rut, I moved up close. It was made of the same material as the fencing, diamond-shaped lattice work pressed out of quarter-inch steel sheeting, the sort you'd see in the windows of off-licenses or the protected kiosks of 24-hour shops. A large chain fed through both gates and was secured with a heavy steel high-security padlock, a pain in the arse to decode and do up again. It wasn't the type that just snapped into position. As I lay along the rut, I could feel the hardness of the ice beneath me and knew the cold would start attacking me long before the Malaskaya did. I wasn't worried about them at the moment, or the players in the house. Fuck 'em. At such short notice, there was no other way to recce this place. The fence looked about 15 meters high and was made up of maybe 3 sections of lattice work, bolted together and supported by spaced steel poles about 1 foot in diameter. The house was beyond the fence, about 40 meters away. There were no Christmas decorations in this one, just the 2 lights. One came from a stained glass panel that I thought was the top half of a door set back on a veranda. The other was coming from a window further to the left. I couldn't see that much detail, but the house seemed quite large and old. It had a chateau-style tower on the far right-hand side, with a Russian onion-shaped dome that I could just see silhouetted against the night sky. I remembered Liv on the way to Helsinki saying that the Russians controlled Finland until Lenin gave it independence in 1920. The old clashed dramatically with the modern. To the left of the house were 5 satellite dishes, massive things at least 3 meters across and set into the ground, looking like something an American would have had in his garden in the early 80s, the sort that picked up 500 channels telling him what the weather was like in Mongolia, but still couldn't give him the local news. This was a proper little Microsoft HQ. I could clearly see their dark mesh dishes looking upwards, each in a different direction or elevation, and they all looked as if the snow had been dug away from the base and scraped off the dish. As I lay there, chin on forearms, taking in as much information about the target as I could, I saw why the bases were dug out. All of a sudden, there was a high-pitched whine that drowned out the noise of the generator, and one of the dishes started to swivel. Maybe they were trying to catch the Japanese repeats of Friends, or maybe they were up and running already. It seemed a strange location for a setup like this. Maybe these people were as illegal as Val. I started to wonder, but soon gave myself a good mental slapping. Who cared? I was here for Kelly, to get this job done and paid for before the dollar exchange rate took another tumble. Getting back to the real world, it seemed that concealment was their biggest weapon. The lattice fence was as high-tech as they got on the security front, apart from the sterile area between it and the tree line. That not only stopped anyone climbing a tree to get in, but also meant they could look out of their windows in the morning while cleaning their teeth and see at once if people like me had been lurking about. I lay in the rut, working out how to get in based on the little information I had. The numbing cold ate through my clothes, and the snow that had found its way down my neck when I fell started to attack my back. My toes were beginning to freeze, and my nose was running. I couldn't make any noise by clearing it into the snow, so I had to be content with wiping it on my icy cold glove. There was a sound behind me. I cocked my head so my right ear was pointing back towards the track. The vehicle was returning. No time to think about it. I just got up and ran back to the nearest of my dive points. To clear the bank and the trees, which were slightly off the track, before the headlights rounded the bend, I had to throw myself about 3 feet up and 5 feet over, just to get near the tree line's branches. I went for it, not quite making the 5 feet and hitting rock again. It probably hurt, but I wouldn't feel it until later. Adrenaline was doing its job, fighting the pain. Ploughing through the snow, trying to get under the branches once more, I listened as the wagon got closer. The vehicle noise suddenly increased as it rounded the bend. I swiveled round on my hands and knees, slowly lifting my head and tried to get into a position from where I could see the track. I didn't bother to wipe the snow off my face in case the movement was detected. A moment later, the 4x4 passed, its headlights sweeping across the gates, the rear lights turning the snow behind them bright red. My face was stinging, but now wasn't the time to deal with it. I needed to take in anything from what the occupants of the 4x4 were going to do to what the front and rear lights revealed to me about the surroundings. Fuck the night vision now. The vehicle stopped just short of the gate, and the red glow brightened as the brakes engaged and the engine idled. Pulling two branches apart with my hands, I saw the right-hand passenger door open and the interior light come on. It was two up, two people aboard, and a very padded body climbed out and started to move towards the gates. The clatter of the chain was momentarily louder than the engine noise. It was left dangling as both gates were pushed inwards, creaking and rattling, just enough to let the vehicle pass. The wagon inched forward, its headlights revealing that the snow beyond the gates and inside the target was full of ground sign, feet and tyres. Just as importantly, no alarms or trips appeared to have been turned off before entry. The headlights splashed across the house, and without the fence in my way, I had a clear view. The building was faced with faded red or brown painted wooden slats and closed shutters on all the windows. The dim light on the left that I'd noticed earlier was escaping from a few missing slats in one of the shutters. The chain rattled again. But I wasn't paying much attention to the gate closer any longer. It was more important that I saw what was being lit up. Looking, rather than thinking. My brain would absorb all the information and I'd work out later what I had seen. I kept my eyes on the 4x4's headlights as they swung to the right. A covered veranda ran along the right half of the house. The gate closer came back into view as the 4x4 rolled to a stop parallel with the veranda railings. I could hear the rustling of a nylon jacket and the crunch of snow boots as the brake lights went off and the engine and headlights died. I heard a man's voice as the passenger shouted something I couldn't understand to the driver as he was pushing open his vehicle door. My nose was stinging and dripping, but I couldn't risk missing a thing as the interior light came on and the driver barked a reply. The gate man carried on past the 4x4 and onto the veranda, as the driver leaned into the passenger footwell and lifted out some flat boxes in a small bag. The pair moved together, stamping their feet on the wooden floor of the veranda to clear them of snow. The driver opened the front door of the house with a key. Light spilled out, and I caught a brief glimpse of a hallway that looked invitingly warm and bright before they disappeared into the house. I stayed still, smearing the contents of my nose slowly into my gloves before wiping them on a tree branch, visualizing my entry, first getting to the house, then into it. After that, I'd have to play it by ear. I didn't even know which room the computers were in. So what was new? I seemed to have spent my life breaking into houses, offices and homes, stealing, bugging and planting stuff to incriminate people, all with hardly any information, no backup if it went wrong, and no recognition for a job well done. The best I ever got was a, "What took you so long?" I had to assume that the 5 meter sterile area from tree line to fence ran all round the house. Even if I could fight my way through the trees and cover up any tracks, there simply wasn't enough time to check. Fuck it. It was too cold anyway. Moving forward to my splash point, I dived out again, this time taking the hit on my knees. I recovered on my back in the wheel rut for a while, just long enough for my shoulder to start reminding me that I'd taken a fall on some rocks on the way in. So adrenaline wasn't entirely effective as a means of pain relief. When I'd got my breath back, I rolled over and got up, keeping my eyes on target for that last look about. There was one more thing to be done. Going back to the gate, I took my glove off and very quickly touched the metal lattice. Then leaned over to the left and did the same to the fence. Only then did I turn round and start hobbling back up the track, waiting for my knees to warm up so I could stop walking like an old man. Once I'd rounded the bend, I pushed my left nostril closed and cleared my right. Then changed sides. It felt a lot better. 20 minutes later, I was scraping ice off the Saab's windscreen. Moments after that, I was heading back towards Helsinki. The heater blasting away fit to bust on hot, hot, hot. The driveway to the lead house came into sight after just under 4.5 hours. I'd stopped at an unmanned petrol station on the way, just 2 pumps and a pay machine between them. It was in the middle of nowhere, and the bright white light burning down from the canopy made it look like a UFO landing site. You just placed your cash or credit card in the slot, selected fuel type, and off you went. I wondered how quickly it would have been trashed and robbed if this was the UK. I took the rest of the drive slowly, thinking things through, compiling a mental checklist of all the kit I'd need to make entry. Pulling up outside the big glass shutters, gagging for a brew and something to eat, I realized I didn't have a key. There was nothing to do but hit the horn. A few seconds later, a light came on and Liv appeared at the door. Thunderbird 3's hangar door opened and I drove in. Before I'd even switched the engine off, she was making a drinking sign. I nodded and gave her a thumbs up, and she went back upstairs. By the time I joined her, she was in the kitchen and I could smell coffee. "So, Nick," she called out as I closed the stairway door, "will you be able to get in?" "No problem. Where's Tom?" "He's working." She came round the kitchen door, indicating the other side of the house with a tilt of her head. "He's broken through the firewall, as I hoped." She said it without any excitement, and noticed my surprise. "You still have to get Tom into the house, Nick. Sit. I'll get the coffee." I did, taking off my jacket and checking baby G. It was just before midnight. I'd see Tom later. There were more important things to be dealt with first. I called out, "You'll need a pen and some paper." She came back in with the coffee tray and writing materials, still dressed in jeans and a pullover. She sat on the settee opposite mine and poured 2 mugs. I picked one up. Black would do fine. What I needed was an instant wake-up after hours of car heating. "I'll run through a list of equipment with you," I said between sips. "I'm going to need quite a lot of stuff." She picked up the pen and pad and wrote as I dictated. She was surprised by my request for 6-inch nails, 150 millimeters once she had converted them, plus a 3-foot length of 4x2 wood, which became a 1-meter length of 100 by 50 millimeters. Why do you need this, Nick? Aren't lockpicks and electronic gadgetry more the sort of thing? Can you get me some? She smiled and shook her head. That's why I want the electric toothbrush. Don't worry. I'll show you what it's for tomorrow. I'll also need the weather forecast, by the way, for a 24-hour period starting at 9 a.m. I liked not telling her what these things were for. At last she was entering my world, things I knew about. There was one last item. I'd also like a weapon, a pistol, preferably silenced or suppressed. She looked genuinely taken aback. Why? I thought it was obvious. Better to have it and not need it than the other way round. Have you any idea of the weapons laws in this country? I reminded her what my Russian friends and I had been doing to her Russian friends only a week earlier at the Intercontinental. It didn't work. I'm sorry, Nick. I wouldn't get you one even if I could. I have nothing to do with that sort of thing. Besides, you were employed precisely because Valentin wanted finesse. The last time I'd gone on a job unarmed, I'd ended up shot. After that, I promised myself I'd always carry, even if I thought I didn't need to. I wanted to tell her it wasn't just finesse that got Val into the boot of the Volvo, but I could see by the look on her face that it was pointless. It was strange. ROC probably had more weapons than the British Army. I thought about asking if her guy from St. Petersburg could get me one, but decided against it. It's always best to keep an ace or two up your sleeve. She stood up. I'm going to bed now, Nick. Please, help yourself to food. I should be back by 10:30 tomorrow with your list. I was beginning to feel hungry and headed for the kitchen. Digging out tins of tuna and sweet corn from a cupboard, I emptied them into a bowl and went in search of Tom as I mixed it up with a fork and got it down my neck. He was sitting at the ThinkPad, his head in his hands. He didn't look up as I came in. All right?
Yeah, all right.
There was a blocked-up nasal sound to his reply. All was not well at Camp Tom. Seriously, you okay? I wanted to sound surprised at finding him so down, but I could guess at the reason. Being so near the witching hour, reality was grabbing him by the throat.
I'm really worried, Nick. You know, I...
There was a big sigh from him, and I knew he was trying to get out what he really wanted to say.
I want to get home, Nick. I don't want to do it, mate. No way am I going back inside.
He didn't want to go back home. He just wanted reassurance that everything would be fine. I'd seen it plenty of times. Men on jobs asking for one thing, but really needing another. Especially when they're scared. It's not a bad thing. Fear is natural, and the secret is understanding that it's normal. Only then can you do the abnormal. Tom, I told you. This won't get you put away. No way would I be doing anything that would get me within 1,000 miles of a prison. I've done some too, you know. He looked up at me with tears in his eyes.
I don't want to go back, Nick. There were some hard boys in there. Know what I mean?
His mouth quivered.
I couldn't hack it, mate.
I knew then exactly what he was crying about. Tom might play at being Jack the Lad, but behind bars, he'd been fair game for the boys banged up for a long stretch. I thought about my time in Borstal and how much I'd hated it. If the wing daddies weren't fighting each other, they were keeping a grip on their little empires and just generally fucking up the lives of those who were within reach. The only way I'd survived, being, like Tom, one of the youngest, had been to act mad. That way the older ones, being locked up and confused about their sexuality, thought I was just a weirdo and left me to it. Because who knew? I might try and kill them if they touched me. I didn't see Tom being able to act that weird and get away with not being made someone's special friend. I nodded and felt genuinely sorry for him. Don't worry, mate. All that's finished with. I guarantee it, Tom. He sniffed and wiped his nose, embarrassed at his display of vulnerability. Best bet is to go have a wash and get your head down. We have a busy night tomorrow. I tapped his shoulder playfully, leaving him to sort himself out. He didn't need me there to embarrass him even more by seeing him like this. Besides, he was coming with me tomorrow night, whether he liked it or not. As I headed back to my room, I thought that, in addition to nails and lumps of 4x2, Liv had better get Tom a brave or stupid pill, depending on which way you looked at it. I started to undress and listened as Tom walked past my door, going in the direction of the living area, probably in search of a glass of water to replace all the liquid leaking down his face. In the shower, I checked out the nice knee, shin, and back bruises I'd got from my snow jumping and went to bed. I was knackered, but thoughts about the job kept me awake, going over making entry and actions on if there was a fuck-up. I must have been lying there for an hour, listening to the hum of the air conditioning, when Tom shuffled past once more towards the living area. He would probably be like this all night now, but he'd live. If he was still wobbly in the morning, I'd remind him again about how much money he'd soon have in his pocket. More than enough to get away from that poxy flat and Janice. I'd already decided that I would give him the full $300,000. Why not? I wouldn't have got this far without him. Another half hour hummed by. I was still thinking about tomorrow night, mentally checking that Liv's shopping list was complete, when I realized that Tom hadn't come back. Yawning, I put on my jeans and shirt and wandered off to have a brew with him. Maybe talk him round a bit more. The lights were still on in the living area, but there was no sign of Tom. I checked the kitchen. He must have gone back and I hadn't heard him. As I turned, I noticed that the door leading to Liv's side of the house was open, and I knew that she'd closed it behind her. Crossing the living area, I started to mooch down her corridor. The door layout was the same as our side, so she'd be in one of the two bedrooms. It wasn't hard to tell which. There was noise coming from the first door on the left. I didn't know who was doing what to whom, but the grunts and moans were unmistakably theirs. I turned back up the corridor, leaving them to it, realizing yet again that I didn't have a clue when it came to women. Chapter 19. Tuesday, 14th of December, 1999. By the time I got up, Tom was showered and dressed, hair still wet, sitting on the sofa drinking milk. He was certainly cheerful enough.
Morning, Nick. Coffee's in the pot. Liv has gone to get your stuff. Said she'll be back about 10-ish.
I went into the kitchen, poured some coffee and checked out the food. I was dying to ask him about last night, but decided to wait and see if he said anything first. I didn't want to sound like a dickhead, and things were getting very weird. First, Liv and her friend at the station, and now this. I wondered if she'd been fucking Tom for years, but immediately dismissed the thought. Once you'd had a taste of Liv, you wouldn't decide to settle down with Janice. And why bother to get me to do the job of recruiting him in the first place? Fixing myself a plate of crisp breads, cheese and cherry jam, I dumped it all on a tray and went and sat opposite him. I put on my concerned face and asked, "How'd you feel this morning, mate? Still want to bin it?" I concentrated hard on spreading my jam.
"I'm sorry about last night, Nick. I was just worried, you know?"
I nodded. "These things happen to everyone at some time or other. Anyway, you look a lot better this morning." I gave him a grin. "There's nothing like a good night's sleep." He avoided the subject.
"It is going to be okay, Nick, isn't it?"
"Of course. I had a really good look at the house last night. It's just a big old mansion in the woods, trying to look like Microsoft HQ. Piece of piss. Next stop, the bank that likes to say yes. That's the beauty of it." I got back to my crisp bread, relieved that I didn't have to deliver another mammoth pep talk. He grinned back.
"Nice one, mate. Nice one."
His head had gone back into jerky chicken mode. I took a mouthful of coffee.
"Yep, it's good we both got some sleep. We'll certainly be knackered tomorrow morning."
He sipped his milk, trying to hide his face in his mug. I couldn't resist any longer.
I heard you, you know.
He turned bright red.
What? What are you on about?
Hey, listen. Good luck, mate. But keep the noise down in future, will you? Some of us old fuckers can't take too much excitement. He laughed nervously, embarrassed, but at the same time rather proud. I couldn't blame him.
What's the secret, Tom?
I mean, no disrespect to Miss Nordic Myth, but warm and wonderful she isn't. Have you met in a past life? He shifted in his seat as embarrassment took over.
No, mate. Never met a girl before. But, you know, I was out here getting a drink when she came out. She saw I was worried and we got talking and that. You know.
I didn't. That was the problem. One minute he's asking me if I trust her. A minute later he's making the earth move for her. Well, probably the other way round. I gave myself another mental slap. Fuck it. I didn't care what was going on. I realised with a shock that I was jealous. I needed to sort my shit out, concentrate on making money and leave anything else that was going on well alone. I got up, leaned over and tapped him on the shoulder. Just make sure you've got those daps of yours for tonight.
Daps?
Plimsolls, whatever you call them. Make sure they're clean and dry. Don't wear them today, just keep your new boots on, all right? With that, I picked up my mug and left. Freshly showered, I lay on my bed and visualised once again making entry on target. I always found it easy to run the film in my head, as if my eyes were the camera lens and my ears the recording equipment. I listened to what the snow sounded like as we walked to the veranda, then the creak of the wooden decking, working out how I would deal with it, attacking the lock on the door and then moving Tom around the house until we found what we were looking for. I replayed the footage 3 or 4 times, from leaving the car to returning to it. Then I started to edit it with different versions. What if Tom and I were on the veranda and the door opened? What if there were dogs in the compound? What if we were compromised in the house? I played the different versions and stopped the film at the crisis points, thought about what I should do and then hit replay, trying to come up with answers. It wouldn't go exactly to script, it never did. On the ground, every situation would be different. But the film was a starting point. It meant I had a plan. From there, if the shit hit the fan, it would be a matter of adapting the plan in the 1 or 2 seconds available, so that I could react to whatever the threat was instead of standing there feeling sorry for myself. I'd been in my room for about 2 hours when there was a knock on the door.
Nick?
Tom poked his head round the corner.
Liv's back. You won't tell her, you know, will you? It's just that, well, you know.
I got off my bed and walked out with him, using my forefinger and thumb to mime zipping up my lips. She was in the living room, dropping her hat and black leather coat on the settee. There was no exchange of eye contact between them, and her whole manner announced there was no time for small talk.
Good morning, she said briskly. It's been confirmed. They're now online.
She must have been to meet her St. Petersburg friend as well this morning.
Could you two give me assistance? There are quite a few bags.
We followed her downstairs, where the first thing she passed me was a sheet of paper with a weather forecast printed out in Finnish.
It says there is a possibility of snow showers in the early morning. That is good for you, no?
Tom was busy opening the rear door of the Merc. What do they mean by early morning? She shrugged her shoulders.
I asked the same question. I'm afraid no one could tell me exactly. Anything between 2 and 10.
I handed it back to her and walked to the rear of the 4x4, not letting Tom see my concern. This was bad. Snow is good for hiding sign, but bad for making it. We had to get in and out as quickly as possible. Otherwise, the only footprints left on the ground at first light would be our fresh ones, not mixed in with the others I'd seen in the compound last night. Unless, that was, the shower kept falling for long enough to cover our tracks once we'd left. This wasn't good at all. You just don't take that sort of risk if a job has to remain covert. But a deadline is a deadline. and I had no choice but to go in regardless. I was flapping, and hoped that God hadn't really been listening to me in Tom's flat, just waiting to get his own back by stopping the snow the moment we got into the house. Tom picked up a set of 18-inch bolt cutters from the back seat and held them out with a quizzical expression on his face. I had lifted the tailgate and was holding an armful of bags and boxes. "Just a bit of standby kit we might need tonight, mate. Come on, let's give her a hand." Tom followed me upstairs, the bolt cutters under his arm and his fists full of carrier bag handles. He dumped it all next to the stuff I'd carried up on the wooden floor outside the kitchen and was soon sniffing around in the bags like a child on the hunt for sweets. Liv was close behind. It was time to put the work disk into my hard drive again. "It's pointless you two hanging around," I said. "Give me a couple of hours to sort myself out here, and after that I'll explain why I needed all this stuff. Make sure those daps are clean, Tom. No mud that could flake off or grit in the soles, okay?" He nodded. Liv looked at him, puzzled.
"Daps?"
"The canvas shoes I've been wearing." He had already put his new boots on. She nodded, mouthing the new word to herself as she logged it in her memory bank and left in the direction of her room.
"I'll see you both later."
Tom was looking at me as she disappeared into the corridor and the door closed. I knew what was going on in his head.
"Don't worry, mate. Not a word."
He smiled, relieved.
"Thanks, 'cause, well, you know."
He waved to me as he walked towards our side of the house.
"Tom, is there anything you need me to do for you?"
"No thanks, mate,"
he said with a sudden twinkle.
"Liv's already done it."
He stopped, turned and tapped his forehead with his index finger.
"Nah, seriously, everything I need is up here. Do you want me to run through it?"
"No point. I'll just concentrate on getting us in and out of there. What are you looking for, anyway?"
He grinned.
"I won't know until I see it."
He disappeared and I emptied the carrier bags and boxes onto the floor. I sorted the clothing first, as it was the easiest to check. Shiny nylon puffer jackets were not what we needed at a time like this. All the stuff I'd asked Liv for was made of wool and thick cotton. We had to have clothes that weren't going to rustle, and they had to be dark and completely non-reflective. No shiny buttons or safety tape. I cut out any Velcro holding pockets or flaps with my Leatherman. Velcro makes quite a noise when pulled apart, and I couldn't afford for that to happen on target. Anything dangling like draw cords I also removed. Once in the house, I couldn't afford for something to get caught and be dragged onto the floor. All this might sound over the top, but people have been killed for less. I'd learned by others' mistakes, and I'd never forget seeing a mate of mine hanging from the top of a fence in Angola by the nylon cord in his combat smock. He didn't have anything to cut himself free with, and had to watch as guards came, stopped to take aim just meters away, and put at least 50 rounds into him. Liv had chosen some good woolen outer gloves for us, as well as a pair of thin cotton contact gloves, so I could manipulate the door lock or whatever without my bare hands freezing onto the metal. There was also a pair of trainers for me to wear, from which I cut out the reflective heel piece. I hadn't ordered any for Tom. He had his daps. We would put them on just before entering the house. Heavy-soled boots make noise and drag in snow, leaving sign. The outside world needs to stay out there. I found the bag of 6-inch nails, some lengths of 1-inch thick nylon webbing, and a handful of metal washers. The length of wood was exactly as specified. I couldn't help laughing to myself at the thought of Liv in a DIY shop. She probably hadn't even known these places existed. There was a neat little hacksaw in a cardboard and plastic shrink wrap. I ripped it out of its packaging and used it to cut half a dozen 6-inch lengths of wood. Liv had done her work well. The washers went over the 6-inch nails and were stopped by the nail head. I slipped 2 washers over each, since they would be taking quite a strain. 15 minutes later, I had 6 fist-sized lumps of wood, each with a nail hammered through. The nail had then been bent into an acute angle about halfway along with pliers,
so the whole thing looked a bit like a docker's hook. The exposed metal of the nail, apart from the bit at the bend and about half a centimetre either side of it, had then been covered with rubber bands to eliminate noise when they were used. Tom and I would use one hook in each hand, and carry one each as a spare. The dark green 2-inch webbing was meant for strapping skis to a roof rack. I cut 4 6-foot lengths of it, knotting together the ends of each so that I ended up with 4 loops. These I put to one side with the hooks, away from the chaos around me. The climbing kit was ready. Liv had been right. The old ways sometimes are the best, and this method took a lot of beating. It was a little gem from the files of MI9, created during World War II, when they were asked to think up new ideas and design equipment so that POWs could escape from their camps and travel through occupied Europe to safety. They came up with silk maps, sandwiched between the thin layers of a playing card and sent in Red Cross parcels. They even changed the design of RAF uniforms to make them easily convertible into civilian clothes. This hook-and-loop device, easy to make and easy to use, was just one of the many ideas they'd come up with for scaling POW camp fences. It had worked for them. I hoped it was going to work for us. Next, I unwrapped the Polaroid camera and 4 packs of film. Once a film was inserted, I took a quick test shot of my foot. The camera was working fine. I stripped the other 3 films of their wrapping. Each cartridge of film contained its own battery power source, but batteries tend to get sluggish in cold weather, and I couldn't afford for that to happen. To keep them warm, I'd make sure I kept them close to my body. Once we'd put on our trainers and I'd made entry, I would take pictures of wherever we were on target, camera noise and flashlight permitting. On a covert operation, everything has to be left exactly as you find it. People notice straight away when something is not precisely where it should be. It could be something obvious, like a folded rug that has suddenly been laid flat. But more often, it's something almost indefinable that compromises the job. They just feel instinctively that something is wrong. Maybe their pen isn't in the position they always leave it, even by as little as 1/2 inch, or the morning sunlight isn't shining through the blinds exactly how it normally does, lighting up 1/2 the desk, or some dust has been disturbed. We might not consciously notice these things, but our subconscious does. It takes in every detail and tries to tell us. We aren't always clever enough to understand, but we feel that something isn't right. A switched-on target will know that even an out-of-place paperclip constitutes a drama, and will take whatever action he feels is called for. The fact that people would be on target gave this job a high chance of compromise, but I couldn't let it affect the way I thought about what I needed to do, just the way I planned it. I'd been successful on similar jobs in the past, so why should this one be any different? Thinking about making entry reminded me to charge up the electric toothbrush. I went into my bathroom and plugged it into the shaver socket. Back in the living room, I picked up the set of Allen keys. A large metal ring held about 20 of the things in order of size. I chose the smallest one and eased it off the ring. The room was beginning to look like Santa's workshop, with sawdust, ripped packaging, plastic bags, clothes tags, and me sitting in the middle of it all. The Allen key had a right-angled bend about 1/2 inch from the end. With the pliers and hammer, I straightened it out until the angle was more like 45 degrees than 90, being careful not to snap the soft steel. Then, having ripped the metal file from its shrink wrap, I started to round off the end of the shorter section. It only took about 10 minutes. Going downstairs to the main door, I slipped it into the cylinder lock to check. It fitted perfectly. Back in Santa's workshop, I opened the pack of Isopon and mixed equal amounts of resin and hardener from both tubes on a piece of cardboard. I took it and the Allen key back to the bathroom. Not many minutes later, the key was fixed firmly to the oscillating steel shaft of the toothbrush, the bit the brush head would normally fit onto. When I'd watched the door of the target house being kicked closed,
No keys had been turned. It had just been shut and left, which suggested that the lock was a Yale-type cylinder. This gadget should do the trick. Bringing back two white hand towels, I sat on the floor and started to file another Allen key the same way. What I had made with the toothbrush and first Allen key was a makeshift Yale gun, a device that simulates a key by manipulating the pins inside a lock. The oscillation of the toothbrush shaft would move the Allen key tip up and down strongly onto the pins. With any luck, it would displace them long enough for the lock to be opened. If not, it would be down to the old way. Still using the Allen key on the toothbrush, but with no oscillation this time. I would have to push up one pin at a time. Then hold it there while I attacked the next one in line. For this, a second Allen key was needed, and that was what I was busy filing down. Once I'd attacked the second pin, I would simply move the other Allen key along, so that it held both pins up, then keep on going until, in theory, I could open the door. That was if it wasn't bolted on the inside, of course. Which it probably would be if they had even one brain cell allocated to security. It took me another hour to finish preparing the kit and packing it into a medium-sized dark blue day sack. Everything was wrapped in my nice white towels, so as not to make any noise or get smashed by the bolt cutters, the handles of which were sticking out each side of the top flap like a Major League V sign. Tom wouldn't be needing a day sack. The only kit he'd have with him was the ThinkPad and leads in their carry bag. Liv emerged from her corridor. By now the jumper was off, and she was in her tight jeans and a white T-shirt. No bra. That would have been interesting a couple of nights ago, but now I was getting on with the job. The circumstances had changed. She surveyed the mess as coolly as ever. Having fun? I nodded. Want to get Tom in to see what toys I've made for him? She walked past me to the lead room, and I got to my feet. I was still brushing off sawdust when they both reappeared. Tom laughed. Tell you what, mate, Lego would have been easier. I smiled my, yes, very funny smile. Tom, I'm going to show you how to use this stuff. I pointed at the hooks and straps by the settees. Okay, but one question. He was looking quite serious. I don't see an egg box or an empty washing up liquid bottle anywhere. He looked at both of us to see if we'd got the joke. I didn't have a clue what he was on about, and nor did Liv. Blue Peter, you know, egg boxes, toilet rolls, sticky back plastic. It was too late for a laugh. Oh, right. Blue Peter. I'd never watched it as a kid. Liv still didn't have a clue and clearly wasn't going to wait for an explanation. Tom watched her disappear into the kitchen. I even got a badge once. Right. Well, there's your clothes, mate. You're going to need a bit more on than you bought yesterday. He picked up the contact gloves and tried them on. Hey, Nick. I'll wear my silk stuff underneath and be a bit kinky, eh? I smiled. As far as I was concerned, silk thermals were about as much use as paper life jackets. Mr. Helly Hansen stuff was the one for me. He pointed down at the hooks and straps. Go on in. What are they for? When I explained, he looked a bit taken aback. We'll be like fucking Spider-Man, or what? His head jutted, but not as confidently as normal. You sure you'll be all right doing this, Tom? Have you climbed before? Sure I have. He thought about that for a second. Can I have a practice? Afraid not, mate. There isn't anywhere. He picked up one of the hooks and twanged an elastic band. Is this the only way, Nick? I mean... Listen, this is the only thing you've got to do for yourself. Everything else I'll do for you. I broke into a whisper, as if we were in a conspiracy that I didn't want Liv to join. Remember, we're in for a lot of money here. He seemed to spark up a bit, and I felt quite proud of my little speech. The coffee arrived, well, for Liv and me. The string of one of Tom's newly purchased herbal tea bags was hanging over the rim of the third mug, We sat down, Tom at my side. Okay, I said. What I want to do now is explain exactly how we're going to get into and out of this place with your... I looked at Liv as she pulled her feet up onto the settee. Box of tricks. There was no need to set out the various phases military style, as if I was briefing an orders group, running through all the actions on for each phase. It would be counterproductive. I didn't want Tom to have so much stuff floating around in his head that I ended up confusing him. If he got muddled, he might get even more scared. He didn't have to know why, just how. I unfolded the map and pointed at the key locations with a pen. This is where we're going to park. Then we're going to walk down here. I ran my pen down the marked track as he took small, sharp sips of his brew. Once we get to the area of the house, we climb the fence using the hooks and straps. Then I'll get us into the house and you can do your stuff. After that, it's out of there the same way. I'll tell you exactly what to do and when to do it. If you see or hear anything different, or there's a drama, stop doing whatever it is you're up to and stay exactly where you are. I'll be there to tell you what to do, okay?
Okay.
I want to leave dead on 9, so you need to be ready 15 minutes before. If the weather's good, we'll be in Helsinki before first light. Then we'll organise the exchange. This time they both nodded. Okay. Now I'm going to get something to eat and then get my head down for a couple of hours. And I suggest you do the same. I was going to treat him like an E.T., escort to target, telling him only what he needed to know, and if there was a drama, all he had to do was stand still. I would be there to take action and tell him what to do. The less the person you're looking after has to think about, the better. I stood up and nodded a see you later to them both as I went to the kitchen for some of the cheese and cold cuts in the fridge. Tom left for his room. As well as not telling Tom too much to save confusing him, I also didn't want to scare him by suggesting anything about dramas, let alone the problems we were likely to have with the snow. Once people get negative thoughts into their heads, their imaginations go into hyperdrive and they start to flap. Every noise or shadow becomes a major event, which slows down the job and also increases the chance of a compromise. Tom already knew what to do if we got split up, without realizing it. Gets himself to Helsinki railway station. He had enough money in that bag to charter a private jet home. I started to pull the fridge to bits, throwing all sorts onto a plate. I'd have loved to have left straight away and be on target before it had a chance to snow, but what was the point? We couldn't get in until people were asleep. I knew better than to worry any more about the job. It only gets you all keyed up, too keen to get on with it. Then you hit the target before the time is right and fuck up. I headed for my bedroom with the food, picking at it as I went. Liv had gone. Once on my bed, I started visualizing again exactly what I was going to do, with some more what-ifs, except that now in my film it had started to snow. There was a knock on the door. I looked at Baby G. I must have been asleep for 3 hours. The door opened and Tom appeared, his long hair dangling over his shoulders.
Got a minute, mate?
Sure. Come in. As if I was going anywhere. He came and sat on the bed, looking down and chewing his bottom lip.
I'm worried about this hook thing. Look, to tell you the truth, I ain't never done anything like that before. Know what I mean? What happens if I can't do it? You know, if I get it all wrong.
I sat up. His shoulders were hunched and his hair covered his face. Tom, it's a piece of piss. Don't worry about it. It's all in the legs. I stood up. This is how easy it is. Putting my hands above my head, I bent my knees and slowly lowered myself till my arse was level with the floor, then lifted up again. Not exactly difficult, is it? Can you do that? He nodded.
Suppose so. Come on, let's see you then.
As he lowered himself towards the floor, knees cracking and creaking, he looked and sounded very uncertain. But he managed to do it. I gave an encouraging smile.
That's all you need to do. If your legs can do that later on, we're home and dry. But remember, small movements. No more than a foot at a time, okay?
Small movements. Gotcha.
He didn't look convinced. Just do what I do. Like I said, a piece of piss.
You sure?
Positive. He bit his lip again.
I don't want to mess things up. You know, get caught or whatever. You know, what we talked about last night.
You won't. Fucking hell, kids do this for fun. I used to do it when I was a kid, trying to bunk school. The school I was talking about was Borstal. And I only wished I'd known this little trick at the time. I would have been out of that shithole quick fast. Tom, relax. Have a bath, do anything you want. Try your clothes on. Just don't worry about it. The only time to worry is when I look worried, okay? He hesitated in the doorway. I waited for him to speak, but he changed his mind and turned to go. And hey, Tom. His body stayed facing out, and he just turned his head. Yep. Don't have anything to eat when you get up, mate. I'll explain later. He nodded and left with a nervous laugh as he closed the door behind him. I stretched out on the bed and went back to visualizing each phase of the job. I wasn't happy about the prospect of snow, and I wasn't happy about not having a weapon. The vegetable knife I'd used to cut the cheese with wasn't much of a substitute. Chapter 20. I got up groggily just after 8 and took a shower. I hadn't slept, but because I'd been trying so hard I now wanted to. Dragging myself to the kitchen for a brew, I found Liv and Tom in dressing gowns, sitting on the settee with mugs in hand. They both looked as tired as I felt, and we exchanged only mumbled greetings. I still had one more thing to do with the kit before I double-checked the lot, so I took my brew with me to my room and got dressed properly.